Let me explain what I'm going to do this morning just before I read so that you don't get confused because it's a little different from normal. What we're going to do is look at this passage in three sections. We're going to look first of all at the history, the historical background, what was the situation at the time. And then we're going to sing a hymn. And then we're going to look at the theology, what is the biblical teaching, the biblical principle that Paul is applying here. And then we'll sing again. And we're going to finish off by saying, what is the meaning for us today? How does this help us to be more effective Christian men and women for Jesus? Okay? So we're dividing the sermon up into three parts, history, theology, and meaning. And we're going to sing at the end of each one. And that's just so that I don't get confused, but it might help you as well. Here is what Paul says about Christian worship. In chapter 2, verse 8, in every church service, I want the men to pray. Men who are dedicated to God and can lift up their hands in prayer without anger or argument. I also want the women to be modest and sensible about their clothes and to dress properly. Not with fancy hairstyles, or with gold ornaments, and I'll be checking later, or with pearls or expensive dresses, but with good deeds, as is proper for women who claim to be religious. Women should learn in silence and all humility. I do not allow them to teach or to have authority over men. They must keep quiet, for Adam was created first, and then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, it was the woman who was deceived and broke God's law. You remember the story from Genesis chapter 3 where Satan, the serpent, tricked Eve or persuaded Eve to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the first sin. It was the woman who was deceived and broke God's law. But a woman will be saved through having children if she perseveres in faith and love and holiness with modesty. Amen. And I pray that God will follow with his blessing this reading from his word. And any of you women folk who haven't yet had babies and who are wearing or not wearing, who are wearing gold earrings, you can just leave now because you're clearly not wanted in the Church of Christ. What is going on here? If you were to visit Parliament at Prime Minister's question time, you might well be disturbed by the conduct of affairs. Maybe you've heard it on the radio or seen it on television, by all of the jeering, the name-calling, the shouting, and the general rudeness of the various members of Parliament interrupting the Prime Minister as he or she tries to answer the questions that have been directed at them. So you might well go and visit Parliament at question time. And I guess Holyrood's pretty much the same. I didn't have a picture of that, but it's probably not very different. You might well come away with the comment, oh, those MPs should just learn to keep their mouths shut. You might well say that. And folk with you might well agree that you had said a wise and a true thing. Those MPs should jolly well learn to keep their mouths shut. Fair comment at the time, perhaps. But suppose you then took those words and put them on a brass plaque outside the Houses of Parliament or the Holyrood building as a rule for all time that everybody had to observe, then it could be misunderstood, couldn't it? Those MPs had better learn to keep their mouths shut, but everybody else can speak out as much as they like all the time. It doesn't matter if non-MPs jeer and shout or rude or name call. It's only MPs who ought to keep quiet. That's not what you meant. Or MPs should really keep their mouths shut all the time. They should never be allowed to make a political speech again, or answer a question from Jeremy Paxman, or even write their campaign literature. They should take a vow of silence and become Trappist monks the day they're elected to Parliament. Might be a good idea, but it wasn't what you meant. You see the point? You can take something that applies to a particular situation and then misunderstand it if you then turn it into a timeless rule for all time. Now, here is Paul putting his finger on specific problems in the church in Ephesus where Timothy was in charge. And he issues three quite distinct instructions. First of all, that men should pray. Secondly, that women should dress properly. And thirdly, that women should learn in silence or with all humility and not try to teach. And there is a danger that these things are misunderstood if we take them out of their historical context and apply them without knowing the situation that they were originally spoken to. So that's why we want to start this morning by thinking about the historical situation. What was happening in Ephesus at the time? In verse 8, in every church service I want the men to pray who are dedicated to God and can lift up their hands in prayer without anger or argument. Well, the first part of that is utterly uncontroversial. In every service I want the men to pray. Could you imagine Paul saying, come to church, all you men, in you come, but whatever you do, don't pray. Clearly not. So there's nothing exciting or unusual there. You might wonder why Paul wrote it. And raising hands in prayer, well, that was just the way it had always been done, certainly in the synagogue, and quite naturally taken on into the church. So he's not saying, aha, I went to one of your church services and I saw you sitting praying with your hands folded. That's wrong. Raise your hands in prayer in future. He's not saying that at all. What confronts us, what surprises us, what is clearly the point of the sentence is to say this, I want men who can pray without anger or argument. That's the point. That's the lesson. That's the error that's being confronted. He's not saying, you men who haven't been praying, I want you to start. Or you men who've been praying with your hands behind your back, I'd like you to raise them. He is saying, you men who have been raising your hands in anger. And remember, we looked at chapter 1, verse 4, where it said the teachings, the false teachings, had only brought about argument and disagreement. So you can imagine a church service taking place and somebody saying one thing or passing on one piece of teaching and somebody else saying, just you, wait a minute, I don't agree with that at all. You see hands raised in anger, pointing fingers of accusation. You wait till we get outside, I'll sort you afterwards. You can imagine how hands could be raised in the wrong sense. And Paul's saying, no, 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 that's not right. It's been happening, but it's wrong. And it's time to stop. You who have been doing this, said Paul, need to behave differently. He doesn't say, I want women who can lift their hands in prayer without anger or argument, because perhaps there haven't been women raising their hands in anger or argument. So he doesn't address what wasn't a problem at a time. He deals with the issue that has arisen. So women are not told to pray. They are told in verse 9 that I want you to be modest and sensible about your clothes and to dress properly. Well, again, you could hardly imagine Paul advising otherwise. I'd like you to come to church looking shameless and immodest next Sunday, please. We wouldn't want any Christian, male or female, to dress improperly. But in this particular situation, it is the women who have been singled out. And it's not hard to guess why. Because every evening in Ephesus, some hundreds of prostitutes emerged from the temple of Aphrodite to perform their religious duty. That's what women did in pagan worship in the church in Ephesus. And presumably they were dressed as seductively as possible for maximum effect. And these women in the church in Ephesus, who had only recently become Christians, they didn't have generations of Christian tradition behind them, so their role model for religious conduct in Ephesus was those temple prostitutes. And so Paul is saying to them here, don't dress like that. When you go out to your place of worship, don't be like your pagan neighbors who have one function in mind. Let it rather be your good deeds that other people notice, rather than your shameless dress. And clearly the temple prostitutes were characterized by lots of gold jewelry and pearl and fancy hairstyles and all the rest of it. And Paul says, don't do that. Don't merge with that crowd. Don't make it your business when you go to church to try and look seductively attractive in order to arouse the particular passions of the men that you're worshipping with. He's responding to the specific situation in the church. And then he goes on to say that women should learn in silence and all humility. Now, learning in silence is not always the only way to go. An inquiring mind that asks questions of a teacher is always a good thing. And most teachers would be happy with polite, respectful questions that would help them to see what their audience understood and what more they could explain helpfully. But at the same time, most teachers would not be happy with rude and arrogant interruptions from ignorant people who thought they knew better and were trying to shout the teacher down to get across their own point of view. People who carry on like that, and by implication that is what some of the women in Ephesus were doing, people who carry on like that should not be allowed to teach or to have authority over anyone. So if there was once upon a time a church somewhere where men came in and raised their fists threateningly at one another, where women dressed seductively and interrupted the teaching rudely, then a response like the one we have read in verses 8 to 12 would be entirely appropriate. Not a vague pussyfooting around the problems. Somebody saying, oh, I'd like you all to try and behave a little bit better if you wouldn't mind. But somebody coming in, putting his finger on the problems and issuing clear, direct, decisive solutions. All these wrong things need to stop. If Paul had been asked for timeless truths to put in a brass plaque outside the church or incorporate in a manual of church or Christian behavior that could apply to every situation through the centuries, then perhaps he would have said something different. And pearls and gold earrings wouldn't have been hammered. But we should be grateful that we have a God who deals with actual situations that real people are in and helps them, helps us, sometimes by encouragement, sometimes by rebuke, to get ourselves out of the mess that we are making or to put right the mistakes that have been made. So that's the historical background, and we're going to, I hope, respond to that by singing this song in worship, which invites God to take our lives, which may have their own specific problems, and to address them so that our whole lives become focused upon the purpose of God. Our hands move at the impulse of God's love. Our feet run to serve God's purposes. Our lives are lived for God's glory instead of to bring shame upon ourselves or upon the church. So we've dealt at least a little with the historical background, and we want to move on now to think theologically, to think about God's involvement in this situation. Paul's three commands to the men to stop fighting and to the women to dress properly and to learn with silent humility, responses I have suggested to the particular problems of the church in Ephesus. The reason we have to go further into the theology is because Paul does not simply say, I would like all these three things to happen because of the local situation, because of the way women dress in Ephesus, or because of the way men have been fighting in Ephesus. If that was the case, if Paul's arguments had simply been anchored to the local situation, then we could have left them behind as we left the local situation behind and time passed on. But that's not what Paul does. Paul goes on to base his argument for these three specific instructions on creation. The very first three books, really the third book of the Bible, and the way that God made the world. So it's not just to do with Ephesus, it's to do with the way that people are, the way that God made us. You should do what I say for, in verse 13, because of the biblical theological arguments which I am just about to present, which are first, that it was Adam who was created first, and then Eve. And second, it was not Adam who was deceived, it was the woman. And that's where this has become a difficulty for the Christian church, especially in the last half century since women's liberation has become more prominent and the crime of sexism has become recognized as serious. Because for centuries it has been argued in the church, from the Bible, from the story of creation, from the teaching of Paul, that since men were created before women, Adam before Eve, men are more important. Or at least, if not more important, certainly better equipped to be in authority. Women can be equal so long as they're happy to be under authority and do what they're told all the time. Women are not fit to teach because by their very nature, it is a feminine trait to be open to deception. Happened to Eve, and therefore it's bound to happen to the rest of the female population, and they cannot be trusted to teach the word of God. And that has effectively been the position of the church, not recently, for much of the church in the Western world, but historically and for most of the Christian church, for most of the world today, that would be more or less taken for granted. With which I have three problems. And the first one is simply that it's not fashionable in the Western world. If I was to go out today and preach that doctrine that women are not fit to teach and ought to listen silently and submissively and acceptantly of everything that I say, then I would not be branded as a popular hero in the press or anywhere else. Men in authority and women shackled to the kitchen sink is no longer an acceptable attitude for people to take today. Now that should actually make us stop and think with caution before we make the change that we might want to change. Because it's not our job as Christians to be fashionable. If the Bible says something that most people no longer think is true, then perhaps it's a truth we need to stand up and fight for, rather than ground that we need to concede. So just because Paul's teaching is no longer in step with popular Western culture, that doesn't give us permission to jettison. But at least it invites us to re-ask the questions. If for 1900 years it was assumed that women were best learning silently and submissively, then going home to prepare the vegetables for tea, then now that things have changed around about us, it's time perhaps to re-examine the questions in confidence that if the truth is true, the Bible will state it, and we've nothing to lose by open, honest inquiry. But also with this conviction that it's right for us to believe what is true and not necessarily what prejudice has always taught. So that's the first problem, that it's no longer fashionable. The second problem is that it was never really biblical. It was never historical in the New Testament. Because in other passages, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 5, Paul says a woman can pray in public and preach the word of God so long as she has her head covered, wearing a headscarf or long hair or something of that sort. Now, we might wonder why she has to have a hat on, but the point is that in that Corinthian church, it seemed to be fine for women to do some kind of teaching, some kind of public speaking, not learning in silence and with all humility. So what is described in 1 Timothy is not the universal practice of the New Testament church. And Paul wrote both of these two letters. Similarly, it's not and never was a New Testament conviction that only women were susceptible to deception by the devil. If you turn back in your Bible to Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, in chapter 11, verse 3, you will read words which are familiar. If you've just read 1 Timothy chapter 2, in verse 11 or thereabout. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, which is on page 230, Paul says to the folks there, "I am afraid that your minds will be corrupted and that you will abandon your full and pure devotion to Christ in the same way that Eve was deceived by the snake's clever lies." Now, that wasn't written to women. That was written to the whole church. So Paul is saying there's a real danger of Eve-like deception hovering over all of us, men or women, which kind of blows out of the water the argument that it's something only women need to worry about. And actually, we don't even need to look at another book of the Bible to work that one out, because it was men in Ephesus who were the false teachers. It was Hymenaeus and Alexander in chapter 1, verse 20, whom Paul had to excommunicate from the church because of the lies that they were spreading, because they had been deceived. It's women in church who he is warning in this particular passage, but it was men who had been sucked in and led astray irredeemably into becoming false teachers. So the argument that it's safe for men to teach but dangerous for women because of the way they are made just doesn't fit the New Testament church's situation. And thirdly, the conclusion that because of the way that we are made, men should teach and women should sit in silence and learn just doesn't follow from the arguments that Paul is using. In verse 13, he makes the point that Adam was created first, and then Eve. But how can that be taken to imply that men should have authority over women? How does being created first suggest that someone has a right to wisdom and authority? The conclusion just doesn't follow from the argument. In the Genesis story, the birds and the fish and the animals were all created before Adam. But God doesn't say to Adam, "Now I want you to go and learn from that warthog, because the warthog was created before you are." And later on in 1 Timothy, he says to Timothy, "I recognize that you're younger than most of the other teachers in Ephesus, but I don't want that to put you off. You've got to instruct them, even though they were created before you were." So there's really no serious argument that says, "I was here first, therefore I should be the teacher," which makes it unlikely that that is the point that Paul is making. So what is the point he is trying to prove? What follows from the argument that Adam was created first and then Eve? Well, if you go back to Genesis and look at Adam as he was created, what do you see? You see a man created by God with authority over the created order, and yet sad and lonely and incomplete. Remember the story? God took Adam to each of the animals, but none of them was found to be the perfect companion for him. And then Eve was made to be his helper, his other half, so that the two could become one. So when Eve came along, she didn't have to attract Adam's attention. She didn't have to, there was Adam busy, I don't know, riding a horse or cutting the grass or doing something, and say, "Adam, cooey, I want you to stop doing that and come over here and notice." And Adam said, "Oh, for goodness sake, there's that troublesome woman trying to distract me from my work again." That wasn't it at all. Adam was lacking something and knew it. And when Eve came along, there was already a role for her to fulfill. And she didn't have to do anything to make herself seem important, because his need was already there. And her proper role was to fill it, to complete the relationship. So maybe Paul is using that argument, Adam was created first and then Eve, not to explain why women shouldn't be allowed to teach, but to say this: you women of Ephesus are like Eve, who was created for Adam. So you don't need to dress seductively. You don't need to get all dolled up or flash as much flesh as you think you can get away with in order to make yourself seem useful or valuable. You don't need to sell yourself sexually like prostitutes in order to have a function in the church. Because in the proper role that God has given you to do, the good deeds that are proper for women to claim to be religious, in that role, in those deeds, there is a value. Whether the men you are with recognize it or not, there is a value in what you do for which God has created you. So Adam was created first, not as all-knowing, deigning in his infinite wisdom to pass on some pearls of wisdom, not pearls, but some wisdom to women, but Adam was created in need of support. And Paul is saying to the woman, come along to church and provide the support that Adam needs, rather than necessarily behaving in the kind of way that he might at first appreciate. Because he will remain incomplete, and the church will remain damaged, no matter how many arguments one Adam wins over another by raising their fists against each other. And just as Adam needed Eve in creation, so your proper function is needed in the church today. And what it was that made both Eve in the Garden of Eden and some of those ladies in the church in Ephesus unfit to teach was not the fact that they were women, as we saw from 2 Corinthians chapter 11, but the fact that they had been deceived. That's the argument. Those who have been deceived, like the woman in the Garden of Eden, should not be allowed to teach. You have been deceived into breaking God's law. You're not now in a position to lay down that law or act as a role model or as an example to others. Look at chapter 4, verse 2, where the word deceived appears again. Such teachings are spread by deceitful liars. And that's probably the connection in Paul's mind. Eve was deceived by Satan. Some women have been deceived by the false teachers. Turn over a couple of pages to 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6, and you get a wee insight into how some of the false teachers were working. It says there in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6, some of them go into people's houses and gain control over weak women who are burdened by the guilt of their sins and driven by all kinds of desires. And if you read the rest of the two letters and work out the context, there were some women who, younger widowed women who didn't have any job to do, had nothing to occupy their time and their attention, who were basically sitting around the house all day with nothing better to do than to be deceived by false teachers, trying to lead folks astray. And therefore Paul says to them, those women will be saved from being deceived by false teachers through having children. There weren't many other career options open for women outside of temple prostitution in first century Ephesus. So Paul is saying, go and do something that God will approve of, something that is of value, something that will make a difference, something that will be occupying and rewarding and fulfilling. And you won't have empty minds to be filled with nonsense. So if your Christian faith and your love for the Lord and your desire to be a holy person is tied to a productive purpose, then you're less likely to be deceived and more likely to be useful in the service of the Lord because of the way you were made. The argument from creation, because of the way you were made, to need each other as men and women in the church and to serve productively and creatively in the business of Christian service. That, I believe, is the argument from the theology of creation. We've looked at the historical background. We've done some of the theology. And the thing's stuck. All that should say next is meaning. Because you see, the danger is, there we go, the danger is that what we do as Christians is we read this passage and say, oh no, that's terrible. If we preach that, we'll be accused of sexism and we'll need to sack all these female elders and female ministers that we've recruited into the Church of Scotland over the last 40 years. Something needs to be done about it. And then we perhaps look at it more closely and come to a different understanding and say, thank goodness we've got away with it. Paul doesn't mean what he thought, what I thought at first. And move on to something else. And the danger is that we don't pay any attention to what Paul did mean at the time. We don't get the meaning from the passage. So just very briefly, I want to point in a couple of directions here. It really deserves full treatment as a sermon on its own, but we haven't time for that this morning. But what I'm suggesting is that Paul's argument from creation is this, that because Adam was created first and then Eve, let Eve's descendants devote themselves not to titillating men and seducing them, but to doing properly those vital tasks for which God created them. Now, in the first century, the only realistic outlet for their talents was motherhood. Well, then let them be the best possible Christian mothers that they could be. Let them make the most of the situation that they were in, just as, for example, Joseph, when he was in Egypt, became the best possible slave in Potiphar's house that he could be. And then the best possible prisoner in Pharaoh's prison that he could be. Not because he wanted to be a slave or wanted to be a prisoner, but because that was the option that was open to him. Therefore, he saved himself from despair and from bitterness by doing the best that he could from God in the range of options that were open to him. And if today the career options for women are wider than having children, and the social opportunities are greater, well, let Christian women still be the best possible lawyers or doctors or company bosses or women of independent means or whatever it is, mothers of children. Let them still be the best that they can be in God's service. Not by rivaling their sin-sick male role models in greedy, bullying, self-assertive aggression, but using their newfound freedom to remedy the mess that men have been making of the world for 2,000 years and more. Just as their predecessors in Ephesus were called to use their genuine feminine characteristics to remedy the mess that the men in Ephesus had been making of the church there. And more generally, men and women both have the opportunity or the choice, if you like, either to use our talents to do what the world finds attractive and will reward us for, in the way that a man will sometimes pay a prostitute for what he wants to get out of her, or else to use our talents and opportunities to do that for which God has created us, things that the world might not value, might not even notice that we are doing at such great cost and with such great effort, and yet things that the world can scarcely do without. So is it your desire, like Aphrodite's temple prostitutes, to be noticed and gratified and rewarded, whether you're a man or a woman? Or is it your desire that God's right to receive from you the service that he deserves and the performance for which he created you? Is it that desire for God to be honored which motivates your life? And so finally, we all need to be asking the question, as we go about our business, have we been rightly taught or shamefully deceived? If we're going to be a teacher of others, whether by word or by example, are we teaching what we have learned in silent humility from God, or asserted ourselves with crude arrogance, having been shamefully deceived by Satan? You see, it wasn't Paul's eloquence or his evident commitment to the cause or his enthusiasm or even his success as a church planter that marked him out from his rivals in Ephesus. The false teachers too had made a name for themselves because they were good at what they did and had probably self-sacrificed extensively to make themselves so dangerously effective. So what marked out Paul as different was his Christ-centered, Bible-based, evangelical gospel truth. And we need to ask ourselves, each one of us, is that why I do what I do? Whether it's at church, whether it's at work, whether it's at home, in all of my relationships with women and men, is that why I do what I do? Because if you are ever asked to explain your strongest feelings, or to justify your fiercest passions, or to vindicate your dearest hopes, so long as you can be sure that you are teaching with confidence what you have learned in humility from the mind of the Lord through the truth contained in his word, then whoever you are, you have not just a right but a duty to stand up and live for and proclaim what you believe. I pray that God will follow with his blessing the reading and the teaching contained in his word.